Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today we are going back to Italy, where we were just over 2 weeks ago. In fact, 2 weeks and one day. Because we have been continuing our quest on the holy relics to do with the Passion. And just to briefly tell you kind of how we ended up in Italy, basically we need to go back a few years, which is that obviously when it comes to holy relics, probably there is none holier or more renowned as the Turin Shroud, which went on a public display 2 years ago in May of 2010. And we went to Turin to witness that event and see the Shroud from up close, if not personal, on a number of occasions. The following year in Easter, we were in Oviedo in Spain, because in Oviedo there is a cloth which is believed to have been wrapped around the head of Jesus as he was taken from the cross. And local scientists have been analyzing that aspect of the cloth and have been able to show that the bloodstains and various other aspects of the Oviedo Sudarium, as it is called, and the Turin Shroud match. Even things like, for example, the blood type is identical, showing that whoever was in the Turin Shroud also was wrapped inside, or at least his head was wrapped inside the Oviedo Sudarium. And then on my birthday this year, we were in Los Angeles and we decided to go to the cathedral in Los Angeles. And after visiting the cathedral itself, we were wandering through a bookshop and we stumbled upon a book called The Face of God, written by a German journalist, Paul Bade. And in the book, he relates the story as to when he was posted at the Vatican, that apart from being very close to, at that moment in time, Cardinal Ratzinger, the current Pope, he also began to read stories about this somewhat miraculous, enigmatic veil, which was about a two-hour drive east of Rome in a tiny little village called Monopolo. And so we began to look into this, and in recent shows of the Spiritual Revolution, we have been referring to the fact that when we visited Lourdes in early July of this year, we stumbled upon an exhibition about this veil at precisely the moment in time when I was reading the book. So we decided that when we were heading towards Bosnia for a tour and a conference there in early September, we would first stop, fly into Rome, take a two-day detour or two-day trip to Monopolo and see this enigmatic veil for ourselves. And it definitely wasn't a disappointment.
No, it wasn't at all. And, you know, I want to back up here and say that those of you who listen to this show on any kind of regular basis or who are familiar with our work know that I am by no means a skeptic, but I like to think that I'm also by no means a pushover. And I have to be really convinced on a number of levels, intellectually, spiritually, emotionally. I try to be holistic about my determinations on whether or not relics have any kind of authentic value from my point of view, obviously. So when I first saw these photographs of the Veil of Monopolo, I was not at all convinced that this could in any way, shape, or form be real. So essentially what we're being asked to believe is that this is one of the cloths. And apparently now in doing even more research in Monopolo, it turns out that there are any number of cloths upon which Jesus has impressed his face, which we'll talk about over the course of the next hour. I have come across now at least seven references to different cloths. All of at one point have been called either Veronica's, based on the legend of Veronica. So of course, while Jesus is carrying his cross on the way to the hill of Golgotha, he falls during the Stations of the Cross. And in Station 6, if you happen to be a Catholic, you will remember that it is Veronica is the woman who hands Jesus her veil because the sweat and the blood is dripping in his face and he cannot see. And he wipes his face on her veil and hands it back to her, and his face is imprinted upon the cloth. So there are any number of different cloths that have claimed to be Veronica's authentic veil in the past. And it's important to note that the Vatican claims that they have the authentic one in their vaults, and this is something that they do not show to the public. We'll talk about this again in a little bit later. When I was in Jerusalem in 1997, I came upon a Greek Orthodox church, which also claimed to have the original Veronica Veil, and which also does not display it to the public. So some interesting hoarding going on with Veronica's veils around the world. So when we first read about this Monopolo veil and started looking at photographs, I said, this is a drawing. This is a painting. There's no way. This is not an image. It doesn't look like the image on the shroud in terms of the way it is impressed. It doesn't appear at first glance in the photograph to be a magical image or a divine impression. It looks to me like a somewhat crude line drawing in certain elements of it. And I was really skeptical when I saw it. I said, look, there's no way this is real. Look at the lips, look at the teeth. They look like line drawings. I mean, this is not a magical image. This is, you know, some kind of, you know, maybe interesting drawing. But there's no way that this is any kind of divine impression. But over the course of our examination, first in reading and then in visiting Monopolo, I am forced to retract my original skepticism and say, although I am not prepared to say exactly what I believe this is yet, I am prepared to say that what the Veil of Monopolo is incredibly interesting. I think at least supernatural. And whether or not is divine is entirely up to you.
Well, and there are several aspects to the veil. And the first bit is that obviously the shroud has had this reputation from the very beginning, actually, of somehow having been a drawing. The first inquiry into how when the shroud was displayed in Lurie in the 14th century basically said, like, oh, this is a crude drawing of Jesus Christ. And it's something which has been going through it forever. But the aspect of the Veil of Veronica or the Veil of Monopolo is simply that it is made out of a substance which is called mussel silk. And mussel silk is so specific and so special that you cannot paint on it. So by default, it cannot be paint. And Paul Bates, in his book, shows you how beautiful and how rich this material is. For example, it was so rich that it was hardly on sale anywhere. It is very fine. It is amongst the finest fabric known. And it was sold in two places, Damascus, if I'm not mistaken, and Alexandria in Egypt. So for somebody to have it in Jerusalem, it would have to be imported from those two big marketplaces. And it would have gone on sale in Jerusalem at extraordinary prices, meaning that this was, as a veil, as a material, as a substance, outside of the cost of ordinary citizens. This was something which only the very rich would wear. And there's also very interesting aspects to the fabric. Bates shows you that when you basically stand behind it, the veil becomes transparent. If it's held up against the light, it becomes transparent. Only under certain conditions can you really see that there is something imprinted, that there is something on this Veil of Monopolo. And the human eye is slightly worse at this than the camera. When we were taking photographs, quite often for the human eye, the image completely disappeared, and for the camera, it was still somewhat visible. But definitely, you know, to all intents and purposes, it is clear that this is something which is truly miraculous from the point of view that the image is visible on both sides. And, you know, the fabric is so thin that there is almost no front and back, so to speak. It is so transparent that it is really the closest thing to what I would say a piece of transparent plastic, you know, was in those days. So, as a fabric, extremely rich, extremely important, impossible to paint on, There are no records in the past that anybody was ever able to paint on it. And today, even though mussel silk is extremely rarely cultivated, all the experts on this are absolutely in unison that this is something which is impossible to be painted upon. So that is the first aspect of this fail. And the second aspect, it has to do with it's the detective story. And in this case, the chief inspector, the chief investigator, is a German nun. And she has a very interesting story. Her name is Sister Blandina. She was a nun in a tradition which was silent, which meant that she was not willing or not allowed to speak by her superiors. And at one point, she stumbled upon the Veil of Manopello, and she somehow had a very visual connection to this, and she realized that it seemed to share many of the characteristics with the Turin Shroud. And this was the day before Photoshop, nor do I think that probably Photoshop is readily available in Christian monasteries. So she had to use basically transparent photocopies and all of that very manual work. And the end conclusion which she reached was, by doing these overlays, that the image of the man in the Turin Shroud matched perfectly with the image on the Veil of Monopolo, including some of the detail. Now, you might say, okay, a man's face is a man's face. Well, first of all, we know that every human being looks somewhat differently. But there is also certain detail. For example, on the forehead, there are wounds which clearly are bloody, which, you know, obviously can be identified with those of the Crown of Thorns. The broken nose. And this is something interesting, because really there are no strong Christian traditions as to how much Jesus was injured. We know, you know, he was subjected to torture, but the physical result of this torture really is not written down in any detail in the Gospels. And so the fact that we have a broken nose in the Turin Shroud and a broken nose in the Veil of Monopolo, and also the fact that there is bruising below one of the eyes, again, are details which cannot be attained by a medieval artist who somehow would say, oh, you know, let's create an image of Jesus Christ and get all of these things exactly right. They are identical. There are actually postcards on sale now whereby one of those 3D image tricks, by holding it and moving it, you can see the overlay between the Turin Shroud and the Veil of Monopolo. So all of these things really show that the Veil of Monopolo is very part of what I would call the Passion, Resurrection, Ascension story, to do with Jesus Christ. But the question is, where does that fit in? Where is the veil's proper role within those final few days of Jesus?
Well, I mean, that is the big mystery, and I think that we'll come back to that in a minute. One of the things that we haven't said about the veil, one of the things that also makes it extremely puzzling for me, and one of the things that I struggle with in trying to understand what this relic is that unlike the Turin Shroud, the eyes in the Monopolo veil are open. And so you have this perfect sort of photograph of essentially the man who is on the Turin Shroud, but how he looked in life. The image in the Monopolo veil, I think it's very important to impress upon this. From my point of view, this is not the image of a dead man. This is the image of a man who is alive. And I think that that's one of the reasons that a lot of people in the past who have looked at it from the church, outsiders, etc., have referred to it as a Veronica. Because the only story that we have where this potentially works in our Christian understanding is Veronica handing him her veil while he is still alive. All other relics that we have from the day of the Passion involve a dead Jesus or a resurrected Jesus. But even the resurrected Jesus, if we're looking at the shroud as a potential resurrection relic, we're still looking at a man with closed eyes. So the open eyes are an extremely important element of this, and they have to be factored into the ultimate question of where does this happen? At what stage does this happen? The other thing I want to go back to with muscle silk is how incredibly thin it is. And you take sort of the texture of a nylon stocking, and it's about a tenth again as thin as that. It's this incredibly fine, fine, fine material. And it's called muscle silk or byssus because it is actually made from fibers that are excreted by mussels. And I'm talking about, you know, the mollusks, the little mollusks that we eat in a frutta di mare pasta or when we have moule frites. You know, that's the kind of a creature we're talking about here. Muscle silk comes from these little tiny fibers that are harvested from mussels, and it's a specific kind of Mediterranean mussel. And by the way, it's an endangered Mediterranean mussel. It was only manufactured off the coast of Italy in Sardinia. So it might have been sold in Alexandria, might have been sold in Damascus, but there's no historical information about it ever being manufactured anywhere there. There are only 30 pieces of mussel silk left in the world. And most of them are quite ancient. They're sort of different sizes. There is an actual coat in a museum that that's made of mussel silk, which is considered the most important piece of mussel silk left in the world. There was only one woman left on planet Earth who is a mussel silk master. Her name is Chiara Vigo. She lives in Sardinia, and she has authenticated the Monopolo veil as a piece of mussel silk. Mussel silk has the texture of an ultra heavy duty Teflon. It repels everything, so it can't be painted upon, it can't be printed upon, it can't be impressed upon. Apparently, a mussel silk master has means in upon which to dye mussel silk, but they can't paint on it. So you can soak dye into it after a very, very, very long process, but that is single colors. There's no way to impress any kind of pigment upon it. So the other thing I want to say is when we went to see this, so we drive to this lovely, lovely town of Monopolo in the Abruzzo region of Italy, which is about 2.5 hours outside of Rome. The veil is on display there all the time. The church is open every day. You can go in any time. It is the most easily accessible relic that we have ever seen, probably because it is not controlled by the Vatican, but it is in fact in the hands of a private monastery. So they are proud to display it, and it's displayed on top of the altar, and it's pressed between two pieces of glass so that you can see that on both sides it is absolutely identical. As Philip said a few minutes ago, there is essentially no front and no back. No matter how you look at it, it's the same. But the amazing thing about it is when you step away from it, you stand back from it for say 20 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet, with light coming through it, it appears to be a plain and clear, perfectly clean, utterly transparent, shimmering white piece of fabric. You can't see anything with the naked eye. Now, they have done microscopic testing on this mussel silk, and there is no pigment anywhere on the veil. They can't determine how or where the image actually exists, because when you take it apart fiber by fiber, there is no pigment on the veil. So it's extremely mysterious and very, very interesting from so many points of view. But this idea of the open eyes are a challenge for me. Now, Sister Blandina, who does the initial analysis of the face, finds something that she calls 10 points of congruence in order to prove that the similarities between the Monopolo veil and the shroud are the same. And as Philip pointed out, this broken nose becomes all important. And I will say the first time I saw the Monopolo veil pictures, I said, that's the same broken nose as in the shroud. I mean, I think it's a thing that strikes you immediately if you're at all familiar with shroud research. Sister Blandina had all of these things looked upon by forensics experts. And again, we're talking now originally back in the 70s when this first all came about. And they all agreed that this face showed the kind of of damage and wounds and injuries that someone who had been severely beaten about the face and had a broken nose would show. So it was consistent with all of those things. And then later on, in our more modern times, in the 20th century and into the 21st, some other testing has been done with computers, with imaging, with that kind of thing, where they're able to overlay the Monopolo shroud on top of the Turin shroud and show that it is essentially also a perfect match, except the eyes are open. So where does this leave us with this sort of fascinating veil with the open eyes? What could it possibly mean? Is it Veronica's veil? I don't believe that it is. I believe that there's something very different going on here.
Well, and traditionally it has been known as the veil of Veronica, and there are, you know, a number of correspondences and a number of issues with that. First of all, the veil of Veronica is basically a woman who is along the path of Jesus' crucifixion route, who takes out a piece of cloth and basically sees how in distress he is and helps him. It's extremely unlikely that this is going to be muscle silk, because if it's the only thing she would have had, then it would mean she's extremely rich, but it would probably not be the first choice, because it wouldn't really have helped Jesus along that way. Also, it's for wiping his face. This is not a wiping cloth. You know, this is something which has a real, true image. It's almost as if, like, if this were the Veil of Veronica, then the story of the Veil of Veronica, the way we know it, is different. It would really be that somewhere along, you know, those last few steps which Jesus takes towards the crucifixion, he performs another miracle, basically, that somehow somebody pushes a cloth in front of him and he miraculously puts his face on this muscle silk. It's definitely not made by a wiping or a swiping movement. So, having said all of that, that it's extremely likely, if not impossible, to marry the Veil of Veronica to what is on display in Monopolo, historically it does seem to be the case. And for that we need to go back to the Vatican. And in 1500s, early 1500s, 1506, this is a time frame when Michelangelo is requested to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, because the Pope of that time is basically doing extraordinary renovation works to St. Peter's. And specifically what the work is being done upon is the fact that some of the artifacts, things like the Veil of Veronica, the Spear of Longinus, and a few other ones, are secreted away in a new container, in a new box, high above the altar of the St. Peter's main altar. And what is happening there is basically that up there, these relics are being now carefully protected, carefully placed. And so for that to happen, the St. Peter's is radically redesigned. Now, we know that at this moment in time, the church claims to possess a Veil of Veronica. And we spoke about on a number of occasions how a priest of the San Fernando Valley Mission, after John Paul II came to his mission, he was basically given an option of what kind of favor, what kind of gratitude the church would express for him. And he basically said he wanted to see the Veil of Veronica. So he was taken up there and basically was able to spend a few minutes with this veil. This veil, which is inside St. Peter's, by all accounts, the church accepts, has lost most of its visual aspect. It is basically said that at one point, the stain, or whatever you want to call it, of Jesus' sweat and blood was visible there, but that as time went on, this changed. Now, people have been looking into, you know, might it have been stolen? Might it have disappeared? And actually, one of the most interesting pieces of detective work has actually been done by Paul Bate. And what he has been doing is basically this. Inside the Vatican Museum, there is a display cabinet. And this display cabinet is basically identified as the display cabinet which once held or was the container for the Veil of Veronica. And at one point, as with so many of these relic cases, it was substituted with another one. But in the Vatican Museum, this specific container is broken, and it appears that the damage is done somehow by smashing it, rather than, an accidental damage. This seems to be the case of some sort of violence. Now, we know that in the middle of the 17th century, the Veil of Monopello appears in Monopello, and the way it gets there is really something of mystery. Some people say that it somehow was given to a family who kept it for a number of decades, if not a century, if not longer, in their private possession. And that at one point they basically put it on the front step of the local church, and that then the veneration of the Veil of Monopello began. And so people are wondering whether in 1506, when the new Basilica of St. Peter was built, whether somehow the, as it is known, the holy face of Monopello was taken out, and that it was then kept in Monopello for over a century before it was put on display. But as usual, when you go to these places, you come up with other information. And in this case, it is just a small little guide of a few, dozens or so pages called, uninspiringly, The Holy Face of Monopello, Tradition, History, Science, and Devotion. And on page 24, it basically starts to give you a slightly more interesting story. And that is that in 1527, Rome was sacked. And we know that St. Peter's was plundered, and that several relics were taken, some of which were returned. Now, there is no record whatsoever that in 1527 the Veil of Veronica was taken. And so, therefore, there is no record of all that it would ever be returned. But we find that one of the people involved in this sacking then ends up living in Monopello and the region there, and he becomes a local landlord. And that is somewhat interesting because basically a possible scenario begins to appear which suggests that this veil was indeed inside the Vatican up until the early 16th century, that the artifact, which is now known as the Holy Face or the Veil of Monopello, was indeed known as the Veil of Veronica. And that in 1527 and afterwards, this was taken to Monopello, and that something inside the Vatican basically was changed. And we know that there have been changes. For example, later on, there would be a strict law forbidding anyone from depicting the Veil of Veronica in art. This was an edict from the church, which really nobody has ever been really able to explain. But there are other mysteries. For example, the current relic, the current Veil of Veronica, the Roman Veil of Veronica, has certain dimensions, and it's quite substantially bigger than the veil which is in Monopello. The display cabinet, which is inside the Vatican Museum, is too small for the Roman veil the way it sits currently in St. Peter's, but it matches precisely the dimensions of the Veil of Monopello. So there is quite an intriguing case to be made here that this veil, which is now 2.5 hours outside of Rome, 5 centuries ago was sitting inside the Vatican, where it was known as the Veil of Veronica, even though it seems that this is not the Veil of Veronica, but that somebody tried to basically, there is this relic clearly linked with Jesus Christ. There is no real evidence that it seems to be anything else but the Veil of Veronica, so it was designated to be the Veil of Veronica, only because probably the image was alive, it wasn't that, and it seemed to be the obvious identification to make, even though I think it is the wrong identification to make.
Well, I think the problem is that we have the age-old conundrum here of conflation. where multiple stories get all tied together. Please, please, please do not send me slews of emails telling me to read Ian Wilson's book, telling me that the Veil of Veronica story is a medieval invention and that there is no proof that it exists until then, blah, blah, blah. I know all that. I know that Veronica means true icon. I know that it wasn't her real name. If you read in the books that I've read, you will also know that I know that. I get a lot of these kinds of preachy letters from people who have read, you know, one or two books on the Shroud and are all of a sudden experts. Please know that we've been doing this for 20 years. I have been doing this on four continents for 20 years. I'm pretty good at knowing where the origins of these stories are. So let me be clear about Veronica. Even though the word or the name Veronica shows up much later, the story does not. And this is what Ian Wilson and a lot of the other writers who try to discount Veronica's story don't get. Just because she wasn't known as Veronica until the Middle Ages doesn't mean she or her story didn't exist. And this is where people get a little bit too anal in their nonfiction life, a little bit too academic, a little bit too trapped in that particular part of history. And most of all, it's because they're not digging hard enough or far enough because they're not that interested in the story. It's easy to say, oh, look, we can prove that the story of Veronica doesn't exist until XYZ period of time. Therefore, it doesn't matter. It's a medieval invention. This idea of making things a medieval invention because they're not mentioned until the Middle Ages is ridiculous. They're not mentioned until the Middle Ages because things aren't really being recorded and written down until the Middle Ages. It doesn't mean that they just start to appear then. It just means it's the first time that they're really being recorded. Incidentally, this story of Veronica has legs all the way back to the first century. It's just that it was about a girl named Bernice, who later turns into the Veronica legend. So this story exists for 2,000 years, even though the name shows up later. But the name becomes part of our problem because Veronica means true image. It has been applied to basically all of these shrouds that are out there, whether it's the Shroud of Turin, the Edessa Shroud, and the question becomes, what is the Edessa Shroud? Was the Edessa Shroud the Shroud of Turin? You start looking at all these different shrouds, and it becomes very, very mind-boggling. There are a lot of different images that are talked about in history that have the face of Christ on them, things that were displayed at city gates, things that were displayed on flags. There's even a couple of really amazing stories about Jesus in his lifetime creating this kind of miraculous image. And this is one of the things that really fascinates me. There are stories of Jesus being invited outside of what we now know as Israel to come and meet with essentially world leaders, which would indicate that people were beginning to understand his importance, maybe not even just as a healer, but also potentially as a member of a royal family, because he's being invited by kings to come and visit with them, which I think we have to understand indicates that he has some kind of status in the ancient world, that we are really looking at someone here of extreme royal importance. Also, as a side note, he is the descendant of David, and one of the historic pieces of muscle silk that is known to have existed belonged to King Solomon. So we sort of see this idea of muscle silk as something that the royal family, the very, very, very elite of the Davidic line was able to afford and might have used for ceremonial purposes. Now, in some of these stories, there are at least two that I've been able to track down of Jesus being contacted by a nobleman or even a king from another land and asked to come visit. One of them is because the king is ill and he asked Jesus to come and heal him. Jesus cannot go, so instead he takes a cloth and imprints his face upon it and has that cloth sent to the king, and the king is therefore healed by it. You know, these are some of the amazing stories that exist in the early literature that have been lost in all of this veil and shroud material. But I think that they matter because when you start adding up all these stories, we come up with 5, 6, or 7 different possibilities for what this image could be. Now, the Monopolo veil is tricky because at first I was trying to see if I could sort of make it work within one of these stories. And I think that I think that the mistake that is being made here by everyone who's written about it thus far, and even by us initially, is trying to shoehorn this very special and unique image into the stories that currently exist. So I think we're trying to say, oh, maybe this was the Edessa Shroud, or oh, maybe this is what they're talking about with that banner, or maybe this is the real Veil of Veronica. The conclusion that I have come to is that this veil is not any of the veils that we have known about. It's not any of the images that have been written about. I believe that this was something that was probably very protected and in a private family or hands for hundreds and hundreds of years until it eventually does potentially end up in the Vatican, who then might label it a Veronica. If it is true that it shows up around the sack of Rome in 1527, we don't know then when the Vatican actually receives it. But we're back again to, when was this image made of a face with the eyes open and of an alive man who has all of the wounds of the bleeding, suffering Jesus before he is crucified?
Indeed, because that's part of the mystery. It's when you try to take it outside of the context of that final week, you might say, you know, okay, so he may have performed this miraculous image, let's say, a year before, a month before, you know, even a week before his death. But the image clearly shows bloodstains. It clearly shows the damage of a broken nose. It clearly shows swelling. Things which show that this is happening on, you know, the Thursday, Good Friday, Saturday. By Saturday, he is dead. Open eyes definitely don't seem to be at all linked with an alive man. And the image, as you're pointing out, is very much alive, of a living human being, whereas the shroud exudes that image of somebody who is dead, who is even laid out as a dead person. So there is evidence to say that this has happened after Thursday night, and seems to have happened before Friday evening. So, again, shoehorning or going with what is known about that period of time really takes us only to one logical possibility, if you, again, want to shoehorn it, and that is the Veil of Veronica. And I think that's pretty much what the church has done. They have looked at the available evidence and they have tried to marry that to what really was known about this period of time, and hence the identification with the Veil of Veronica. But again, from a logical perspective, it doesn't work. It's not a substance which you would give to somebody who is in pain and wants to clean his face. It's also not the type of image which can be made by somebody casually wiping his face on a cloth. So, to some extent, I would say that it is definitely the historical Veil of Veronica, that this is the object which, you know, history and the church has identified as the Veil of Veronica. But it's also clear that it's not the original Veil of Veronica.
Well, one of the things that we have not mentioned is that it is impossible to carbon date muscle silk. You can't carbon date muscle silk because muscle silk does not contain carbon. So there is no way to actually date the image or the cloth upon which it is imprinted or impressed or appears. So this is the other trick. So the only thing we can do is try to determine where it shows up, and that is also tricky. You know, it's one of those things that when you're standing in front of it, and you know, there are busloads of German people and you know, coming to see it, and you realize that, you know, it's known by the faithful in Europe and the small groups who come, but basically no one else knows about it. It's really quite amazing and quite fascinating. I think it's the best kept secret in Christendom, and possibly the most fascinating. I would love to take groups to this place and let them just, you know, spend some time with it and take a look at it and see what they think. Now, I will say the one thing that was not missing for me, but didn't have the impact on me that I thought it would, was the sort of spiritual, emotional element of it. I wasn't deeply impacted by it. I mean, the Shroud of Turin almost, you know, brought me to my knees on every occasion that I've ever stood in front of it, which is three. The Shroud of Oviedo, I felt, you know, in every fiber of my being. I didn't have a dramatic emotional and spiritual reaction to the Monopoly Veil, which surprised me. But I did, I do have an incredible fascination with it. I do believe that this is an authentic and very, very mysterious relic. Trying to make it fit onto the Day of the Passion is the piece that I find a little bit difficult. Now, of course, we are not restricted. Our hands are not tied like the hands of the Vatican. They can only try to put a veil of this magnitude into the story as it is told in the Gospels. They really can't go outside of that. You know, they have to try to make it Veronica's veil because it's the only thing that works. By the way, Pope Benedict has a deep reverence for this veil and has gone to visit it. And there are lots of photographs of him coming to see the veil and all of that. I believe it was in 2006. And that was kind of when it first was put on the map. And then Paul Bade wrote his book shortly thereafter, which was, I think, only in the last year translated into English. So it's, you know, this is up until now a really relatively unknown relic. The issue is, you know, at first we said, okay, well, you know, Jesus was by some accounts beaten very badly when he was arrested on Thursday. So maybe this impression could have been made prior to that. The problem with that, maybe because it's possible his nose could have been broken in the initial arrest and in the initial beating that he endured prior to the events of the morning of Good Friday. However, we have puncture marks on the forehead and we have blood stains along his hairline, which indicates the crown of thorns. And if this is a crown of thorns indication, then now we are strictly on the Via Dolorosa. We are strictly on the path to the cross. This is the only time that this could happen. Or is it? Now, in July, I think we talked about this on an earlier show. We were in Lourdes having a not so wonderful time in the Las Vegas of Christianity. And right when I was about to lose all hope for the future of the spirit of humanity because of everything that we witnessed at Lourdes, we walk out and we see this enormous, like three-story high image of the Veil Monopolo hanging on a building. And we discover that they have had a special exhibition during the month of July, I believe it was, about the Veil of Monopolo and what it is. And we were thrilled. We're like, oh, wait, that's our veil. We're going to see that veil, you know, outside of Rome. We've been reading about that. Let's run into the exhibition. I think there was about 20 minutes left before the exhibition closed. And I mean closed forever. It turned out that we're probably the last people to view the exhibition in Lourdes. We ran in and we got in to see it. Now, what was interesting, we're going to, you know, write this up and publish this a little bit later. We're still working on getting everything together from the last few months because we've had a lot of input. There were some very interesting diagrams that had been created for this exhibition about where this veil might have come into play. And the theory that was being put forth in the Lourdes exhibition, which I understand was influenced by Sister Blandina, showed it as one of multiple burial cloths that were on top of Jesus in the tomb, so that it was a cloth in addition to the original Shroud of Turin, so that there would have been a layer of different cloths on top of him. So the idea is that there were multiple layers of cloth on top of him, and that both the Shroud of Turin and the Monopoly Veil would have been imprinted at the same time. Again, my problem with that is one has closed eyes and one has open eyes.
Yes, and that is really, you know, Sister Blandina, I think, is extremely aware of the problems, and she, we saw her on the second day we were there. She was in deep reverence for the Shroud. She really has a devotion to this object, which is you know, extraordinary to see. Just to finish her story, she was in a German monastery where she was not allowed to speak, yet she wanted to get her information out, and her superiors gave her specific compensation or whatever the correct word is, dispensation, so that she could leave the convent and move to Monopello, that she was allowed to speak. And she's spoken a lot. In fact, when we were there again on the second day, she was leading a group of German tourists around, telling them about the veil. So she has made this her life work. She has a display near the church, which you can visit if you go there. She really is the person who, in a very scientific manner, actually, one of the things which I would like to highlight about her is that she has a very beautiful mixture of devotion, religious devotion, but also scientific enterprise. She is a nun, but she's a very scientific nun, if that makes sense. She really has come to this conclusion that this is something very special through a process of devotion of heart and of the mind combined together. And that's what definitely makes her an extremely special person, and also somebody who really has dedicated her life to making this. And I think it's a good thing that her community, her congregation, realized this and allowed her to get out so she could perform that work. On a practical note as well, if you go to visit the veil, you really need a car. You need to organize yourself. Monopolo is divided into three sections. Basically, Monopolo Scalo, which is if you were to come by train, this is where you will end up. It's a small town. It's got a bank, a few shops. Then there is Monopolo proper, which is this very medieval town on top of the hill. And then you have the shrine itself, which sits outside of both of them. It sits on top of a hill. You need to drive there. There are stations of the cross around the drive up. There is no taxi service, as far as we were aware. We rented a car, and that is definitely the best means of doing this. Or, of course, find out whether there are organized trips. There definitely are organized trips. There are Italian tour groups, German tour groups, probably other tour groups who come there. But those will spend an hour, maybe 2 hours there. If you really want to have something more extensive of an experience, you need to organize it yourself. Fortunately, there is actually a hotel in about 50 yards away from the church. It's called the Villa Party. It's lovely. So if you want to devote time and go there, rent a car and stay wherever you want, but there is one very nearby. But the mystery of the veil continues. It's putting it into this context of, it's a layer on top of the Turin Shroud. If it is, then by its very fabric, I guess, and the linen, it would have to have been straight on top of Jesus' face. And then on top of that, it would have to have been the Turin Shroud. It's the only kind of logical way through which the stain, so to speak, of the Turin Shroud could be created. It's a very thin fabric, this muscle silk, and it would have allowed for that. However, there are various discrepancies. The eyes are open, two inside are closed. One of them has color, the other one is just bland. When I say a stain, it is because it's basically all of a single color. This has the reason why the veil was quite often confused for a painting was because it has this vivid coloring, and that is obviously not the case with the Turin Shroud. So, trying to put it as a layer in this wrapping of Jesus is to me an interesting avenue to take, and we've definitely been learning things like relics of the Holy Cap in Cahor, which we spoke about earlier as well. But in my opinion, it's not going to give us the final answers as to how this veil was created.
I also want to emphasize that there is no blood on the Veil of Monopolo. There is no way to test the blood. We know from the Turin Shroud and from the Oviedo Shroud that the blood, not only the blood stains are similar, but the blood type is identical. And that is an AB positive blood type, which appears on every relic related to Jesus that has blood on it that has been typed, does match this somewhat rare AB positive blood type. There is no blood in the Monopoly Shroud. Was there ever? We don't know. I think that going back to this extraordinary, shiny, shimmery Teflon coating, I don't think that blood would have necessarily stuck to it. Although it is dyeable, and so I would think that if this were laid directly upon the face of a man who still had bleeding wounds, that something might have sunk into the cloth. Is it possible that this veil was laid on top of the Turin Shroud? But then we're back to eyes open, eyes closed. I suppose one of the places we could go with this, and I'm really, you know, talking through different ideas, just to kind of give air to all the possibilities, is one could be a death image and one could be a resurrection image. Are we shown Jesus with his open eyes, looking alive in the burial cloths, at the same time that we're also shown what is clearly a dead Jesus, so that we are given two different images. This is sort of a before and after resurrection celebration. And if that is the case, I mean, that is certainly, that certainly changes things, doesn't it? I mean, if it's something like that, I think that makes it truly extraordinary.
Well, and speaking of that, there is a new book out about the Turin Shroud called The Sign by a person who, if I remember his name correctly, but I might mispronounce it, Thomas de Wellaby. And he basically has been, you know, writing about this thing. And he's basically saying one of the reasons why the Turin Shroud is so controversial is because for science, it's a medieval fake. And as a result of that, the believers and those who have, you know, come to this belief through scientific means have gone so far over to the other end that they're beginning to see this as evidence of the resurrection, that somehow the image of the Turin Shroud can only have occurred through miraculous means, that this is somehow living proof of the fact that Jesus resurrected, that somehow, you know, when he resurrected, that this imprint was made on this cloth, and the techniques which some people are proposing is like, you know, like radioactive emanation from cells, and various theories are being pushed there. And he basically says that we shouldn't go there, that some of these theories are too out there, that some of them are actually impossible. And instead, he proposes, you know, he's not a skeptic. He says the Turin Shroud, in his opinion, is absolutely real. He just says that, in his opinion, it's not evidence of the resurrection. And he points out at one point in his book that actually the church has made the idea of resurrection and ascension identical as well. And he says, like, you know, even though the church doctrine clearly says it's 40 days apart, somehow, you know, this, we kind of like assume that Jesus went to meet his father, God, on Easter. And so he's pointing out certain kind of ideas, which, again, conflation. And he's pointing out that, you know, basically the Turin Shroud has become this image of the ascension, of the resurrection, as if this was a single event. And maybe, and again, this is complete maybe, because at this moment in time there are no answers, maybe indeed the veil of Monopolo is more evidence of something miraculous happening, whereas the Turin Shroud, I think, is direct evidence of the fact that Jesus was a living, breathing human being who was indeed crucified, and that, you know, the Turin Shroud is more factual evidence of the fact that Jesus absolutely existed, which, you know, in the big world out there is heavily debated and questioned by several hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people who cannot get their head around, who somehow feel that Jesus is an imaginary creation. So various possibilities, and I guess the future will tell.
Well, we will continue to research and let you know what our findings are. You might have already guessed that we have a little more information than we're actually revealing at this moment, because our investigation the next day in the local region turned up some very, very interesting things, including a very interesting church and some very interesting images within that church. So we have been led to potentially a new story of what this veil is, where this veil comes from, and who originally possessed it. And why it might matter. But that is another story for another day, because it's not quite ready to come to light. And we don't mean to tease you. It's just that it's an important story and we want to get it right. And by the time we reveal, what we think this might actually be, and how it might actually have occurred, we want to have everything really well put together and presented as a total piece. So that is a future show and potentially a future publication wherein we will show you what our findings are, but we will share all of that with you. I do want to say that I have a new blog called Legends of the Divine Feminine. And if you go to legendsofthedivinefeminine.com, you will see my blog post on the Holy Veil of Monopolo, along with some pictures that I took while I was there. There are a few pictures of the veil itself. And then there's a couple of images as well of how we see these gossamer, super, super thin veils depicted in Renaissance art. And the question becomes, were these images of muscle silk? Did the Renaissance artists know that these kinds of muscle silk veils were used by the elite of the ancient world? And would these elite women of the ancient world also have been spiritually important? Were these veils of a type of priestess versus just veils of a queen? Is it a different kind of queen that we're talking about here? Is this idea of muscle silk, something that comes from the sea, related to this idea of the priestess who also comes from the sea? The ultimate the birth of Venus, if you will, type of image, or all these things tied together. Is this veil the veil of a very, very important spiritual woman? So that's the little hint I'm going to leave you with. But in the meantime, if you visit legendsofthedivinefeminine.com, you can read a little bit more of the blog post that I wrote and see some of the images that I have posted.
And that kind of like means we have done, I think, 3.5 ticks on basically all the images related to the Passion. 3.5, obviously, Tomb and Shroud, Oviedo Sudarium, now the Holy Face of Monopolo. The half one comes really from the Holy Cap of Cahors, which we visited, but it is no longer on display. So we'll give ourselves half a mark for that one, I think. And next year, we definitely will be heading into Germany, where there are some more clots set to be linked with the death of Jesus, which we will investigate. And at that moment in time, I think we have pretty much done and visited all of them. If you know of any other ones, please get in touch with us, and we will definitely be more than willing and anxious and hungering to investigate anything to do with this period of time and the mysteries involved with it. But that will not happen in the next few minutes or even hours, because right now we have come to the end of this show. As usual, you can listen to this and various of our other shows in a number of ways. There is our very own website, thespiritrevolution.com. You can go into the BBS Radio archives. You can also go to iTunes and just type in The Spirit Revolution, and you will get almost 2 years of our shows, and you can listen to them completely for free. Dozens of hours of Kathleen and me talking, sometimes just amongst ourselves, and sometimes with very beautiful guests who we had great pleasure of talking to. But that is, as I said, all for now. We will be back next week with another one of our shows, but until then, from the two of us,
the truth against the world.